This program is brought to you by Podcast One Sports. He is currently the head football coach of the University of Michigan Wolverines and a former player. His dad and brother are also former players and coaches, but there is more to them than just football. It's time to talk about attacking life each day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind. This is Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast with Jim Harbaugh.
Welcome to another episode of Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast. We encourage you to subscribe to us on iTunes. You can rate us 5 stars or 4, I guess, if you think we're decent. We'd prefer that you don't go any lower than that. Occasionally we get some dissenters on iTunes rating us less than that, but for the most part, it's 5 stars. I know you. It's tough to believe, Jack. There are some people, mostly fans of other teams, that just go on there.
Yeah.
So you could get how that takes place.
Dastardly act on their part, I might add.
Yeah, I mean, very just conniving and really sticking it to us, you know.
Well, Riley Crean said he's going 7-8.
He's going what?
7-8 stars.
Is that 7/8?
7-8 stars. Number 7-8.
Yeah, you're only allowed to give 5.
He isn't aware of that.
Okay.
He's been doing a 7 or 8.
Okay. How many is that out of in the Riley Crean star spectrum?
I believe 10.
Okay. All right. Then we're going to keep trying to be better today than yesterday and better tomorrow than today. So we're going to have Alan Trammell with us on today. And he's pretty good friends with John Falk, our equipment manager. So John Falk appears from time to time. And he's going to be joining us to talk with Alan Trammell, who is a Detroit Tigers legend, who is going into the Hall of Fame after over 15 years of being snubbed. And he's from San Diego like I am. So we've got a lot in common and looking forward to talking to him about his career, his teammates, and everything like that. And we've got some playoff football to talk about and some good movies. So we're kind of, you know, we got some good off-season topics, I think, Jack. So I guess we'll get right into it. So the NFL playoffs, the first thing I want to mention is that the Pittsburgh Steelers were very confident going into this game. And a couple guys were even talking about how they were looking forward to their next game against the Patriots. You know, after they take care of the Jaguars, they're going right on to the Patriots for the AFC Championship. And they got with a former player of Coach Jim's after the game, David DeCastro. And David said, not a big fan of looking past an opponent, especially one that had beaten them earlier on in the season, and wasn't really quite sure why anybody wasn't focusing fully and entirely on the Jags, and accordingly and as such ended up losing. So do you have any advice for not looking past an opponent, or any personal experience that you care to share that way? I mean,
I've been in football for 55, 60 years. I think one of the first lessons you ever learned as a player or a coach, whether it was junior high school football or high school football, do not incite the opposing team. Do not give them any bulletin board material. They'll find enough to excite them and to fire them up without giving them any of that kind of material. So I think David was very insightful in describing that that's not what you want to be as a football team. That's not what you want to do, because the Jaguars played an outstanding, outstanding football game.
Coach Jim is out on the road recruiting, so he's not going to be able to join us today. This is a busy time of year, and we'll see if we can get him next week, perhaps. But you know, as a coach, having played for him and having seen his career, I can't really imagine him. I don't remember him rather taking any opponent for granted. It's always about the next game and never looking past somebody onto another opponent.
Remember Lou Holtz when he was coaching at Notre Dame, and before that Minnesota. He would give a scouting report on Monday to the press and to the public, and every team that he played, whether it was a team that was the 126th ranked football team in the country, he made them sound like the Green Bay Packers coached by Vince Lombardi. I mean, the offense was an offense that you could not possibly stop. The defense that they were playing against was a defense that we could not possibly score upon. It didn't matter who it was, so it got to be almost farcical when you listen to his preparation for that team. So as a former coach, I would suggest maybe going with the Lou Holtz approach to preparing for games than the Pittsburgh Steelers had gone in preparing for the Jacksonville Jaguars.
So after Lou Holtz, you know, previews playing Northern, Southern, Eastern, Western A&T, and they're 70-point favorites, and he talks about how great they are, and then they end up winning by 60 or 70 points. And a reporter says, "Well, you thought this would be a more difficult game, How did it shake out that you were able to win by so much? What was the typical refrain that he would give after the game, you know?
Well, then it was all his football team had risen to the occasion against this powerful opponent. And,
yeah.
And how pleased he was as a coach that they took his point of view on that and took them very seriously and played one of their most outstanding games of the year.
Now, Jack, I don't know that we've gotten to this story on the podcast, and it's one of the few moments in your career where maybe you've given the other team a little something to kind of give you a hard time about. But there was a game, you were up by a couple scores, and you got the chair.
Oh.
Could you tell this story for me? Because this is one of my favorites. Ira, I think you'll enjoy this.
This story was told by – I had forgotten about it. Joni brought it up when we were down at the bowl game down in Tampa. The Crean family came over to the hotel, and we're talking about those times, and Joni remembered this as one of her all-time favorites. We were playing, I think it was Southern Illinois, and it was in the middle of the fourth quarter, and we were up by two scores, three scores. I mean, we were having an outstanding game. And the student body, the section, was right behind our bench. And they were all over me for some reason. Harbaugh, Harbaugh. And it was all things that were not complimentary. Things about family and things.
Offensive.
Very, very
personal.
Personal in my life. And so they kept going. And so we score. We got up by three scores. So I thought, I had enough of this. So one of those folding chairs, you know, those folding chairs. There was a folding chair out there by our bench, so I took the folding chair, walked onto the track.
Deliberately, slowly.
Walked with the folding chair to the student body section, and I'm about 15 feet in front of them.
And how far from your sideline? Maybe 50?
Not that. No. It was a kind of a tight sideline there, if I remember.
But maybe split the difference.
Split the difference.
Okay.
Maybe closer to the student section.
Okay.
than to the sideline. So the players were all watching. So I took the chair, unfolded it, put it down to where I was. It was kind of, I call it in Crestline language, cat a corner to the bench, so they could see it. So I crossed my legs, put my arm over the chair to the student body, and kind of gestured, "Look at the scoreboard." Now that just really, really, really set them off.
Now they really started getting after you.
Now it went to another level.
Uh huh.
And so as I'm there doing this, one of their players broke out. And it might have been that our players were laughing and pointing to me and not paying attention. I could have been that.
Okay.
They broke and scored. They went about 60 yards on a run. So now it's a two-score game. Student body now, they go. So I stood up, took the chair, folded it up, kind of put it under my arm, walked back, and got involved with coaching our team again. And Joni remembers that as one of her all-time favorite moments. And I must say that it was not one of my favorite all-time moments.
I love the humble pie that is dished out on the sidelines of these games. You remember John at Western Michigan, throwing his headset or his hat or whatever, and then you're like, go pick that up. And then Coach Jim coming over being like, throw a pass or I'm leaving. And then throw a pass, it goes for a touchdown. It's the sideline stories are great.
You know, so much fun. You know, I don't know if there's as much fun as there used to be with dialogue with your players and interacting with the with your team and with the fan base and all that. And maybe it's good that we don't have it anymore. But I enjoy those kind of interactions.
Could you imagine? I mean, there have been fairly minor instances of Baker Mayfield maybe mouthing something or people gesturing sideline to sideline. I mean, could you imagine your story of taking the chair, going onto the track, if it were in today's day and age? I mean, it would have exploded. Would have broken the internet.
See, there was no television. No, there was no mention of it. It wasn't the
maybe
lead
on
story.
The radio.
Maybe, but
if
probably
they had
not.
A vantage
probably
point.
Not.
Yeah.
It wasn't on the lead story of SportsCenter on ESPN. It was just a moment that you had. And I will say this. I never again took a folding chair and moved it in front of the student section.
You've learned.
I moved on.
I've got so on the heels of Dick Vitale last week talking about his gala down in Sarasota. Coach will be there Mother's Day weekend. You're going to be there. Sounds like Dick's going to have tickets for you. We couldn't really pin him down on tickets or being an honorary captain. He was kind of evasive.
I was a little surprised. We talked three or four times about Jack and Jackie and will Jack and Jackie have seats? Jack and Jackie will have seats, and we had no response whatsoever. Do you think maybe I should get a ticket, or maybe I should wait till I have something more definitive on whether we're invited?
I'll try and pin him down. I thought we eventually got to him approving you attending with Jackie, but I almost felt like it was like a Dickie V plush doll. You're like, hey, can we go to the game? And then Dickie V would be like, it's awesome, baby. And then you'd be like, well, do we have tickets? He'd be like, he's a diaper dandy. You're like, well, it's not right.
Jimmy, it's so good to have you coming. How about mom and dad? Jimmy, we're so happy.
It's like, wait, God, if we could just get Jack and Jackie there, then it would really be complete. So that was it was funny. Dickie V's one of a kind. And hopefully you'll be down there in May, and maybe I can tag along and maybe be like a busboy there or something. We can find ways to make ourselves useful down in Sarasota. But I say all of this, he's going to give at least $250,000 to Chad Tuff and the Chad Carr, the Chad Tuff Foundation. And he's raised over $20 million for pediatric cancer research, which has been fantastic. And the Chad Tuff Gala, where Coach Jim and Sarah were the co-chairs last year, that was awesome. They're going to be there again this year. And I'm actually participating in a Chad Tuff function, Dancing with the Stars. Now, I'm not familiar with the solar system or the different types of stars, you know, the red dwarfs or the supernovas or anything. But when I think about me being called a star... It doesn't quite sit well with me, but in the interest of, you know, humility. Taking after the ABC show, yeah, in the interest of humility, I'll just go with it. And so I will be dancing with the stars.
Oh, are you emceeing it?
No, I'm dancing.
Oh, you're actually the dancer?
I am dancing.
You and Mara are going to...
No. And so this is another area of contention. I will have a female dancing counterpart. And Mara's a little worried, but I've assured her all above board. You'll be very, you know, be there for public consumption. I don't want to do anything, and I take lessons at the Arthur Murray Dance Studio here in town, and so I'm doing it, and I'm competing against Coach Backich, the head baseball coach, and some others, and I am doing my routine to Sir Mix-a-Lot's Jump on It, and it was originally done by the Sugar Hill Gang. I'll have to have you take a listen to it, but it's a...
You're speaking a foreign language, an absolute foreign language. I have no idea.
Okay, how about this? Are you familiar with the song Baby Got Back?
No.
Okay, well, it's about, you know, kind of backing that thing up a little bit, and it's...
What's that one? I don't watch Dancing with the Stars. I've seen them early. I watch them very, very, very early.
Uh-huh.
What's that one dance they do, that salsa?
So I'll be doing some salsa-ing in my dance routine. But yeah, I mean, the salsa kind of stepping forward and then stepping back, and then there's some routines to that. Step back, you know, twist. And
I must tell this story, though.
Okay.
When we were your freshman year at San Diego.
That's right.
I was the running backs coach, and you were on the team for about 2 weeks.
Yeah. Freshmen are to be seen and not heard.
And you were doing a fantastic job on our demonstration team, and I was so proud of you. And then Jim decided that we would take our football team to a women's volleyball game.
And we have a great team. Jen Petrie, still great coach, still there.
And it was a magnificent evening, and we were sitting there, and there was a timeout, if I recall. And the music came on, some kind of like that kind of dance music that you were just describing here for us that our audience can't really see because it's radio, right?
Yeah. But
anyway, you were doing a little dance routine right here. And so when the music came on, you jumped into the aisle, if I recall.
That's right.
And you went into this dance routine, and your arms were gone and your legs were gone, and our team roared. I mean, and then every time out after that, the expectation was for you to get up and which you did, and our team went on to victory that particular day, and that was one of the coach's comments after the game, how inspirational you had been with the dance routine, and described that as a reason for, well, I might be a little exaggerating on that, but that's one of the great moments that I have of you, JT, there at the University of San Diego.
So just, I'll tell you how I remember it. You know, football team typically is like a funnel. You've got a lot of freshmen, you got some sophomores, handful of juniors, and then your seniors are normally, you know, it's been whittled down to that point. So your seniors that are there normally are important and they contribute well, and the USD team was mostly constructed that way that season. So overwhelmingly there was a lot of positivity, but that was mostly from the freshmen and sophomores. the juniors and seniors didn't really see it that way.
One more point, if I might.
Please.
That's the way you were on the demonstration that team that entire year, and you were such a pain to our starting defensive team. You were a running back, and you would not give it the brother-in-law. We all know the brother-in-law is the number one defense, wants you to take it easy on them and not run hard and not block and in practice to give them an easy day of practice. But you would not fall into that trap. I mean, every play for you, you were running a play that would determine our national championship status. And they kept telling you, JT, get down. And you would kind of laugh and bounce and jump back into the huddle to where it got to. I worried for you because it looked like they were trying to take you out.
And I don't remember it that way, Jack, but I've had so many people corroborate your version of it that I guess I was that much of a prick. For lack of a better term, I think I was just...
But I will say this.
Yes.
I said to myself, this guy has something special. He is going to be a great football player here at the University of San Diego, and that came to be.
And with a little bit of instruction about how to run the power play and how to hold on to a football, I managed, you know, through your tutelage and guidance, I managed to become the all-time leading rusher and never lose a fumble.
Well, what was your all-time phrase? What all-time phrase did I gave you that you recall?
You know, if I had to go, I'd say like water running off the table.
That's what I was thinking,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, the cutback. I didn't want to talk about the soft shoulder because that's kind of a tactic, not a phrase, so to speak. So a lot of good ones, though. And I don't know that anybody knows necessarily what your tombstone is going to look like. And I know it's a little morbid to talk about it, but I figure you got another 20 or 30 years in you. What are you going to put on your tombstone? Most people say date born, date deceased.
No, we will not have a name. There will be no name on it. There will be no date of birth, date of death. There will be no, it will just be the diagram of the power play. You know, the gap scheme.
Yeah.
The fullback kicking out.
And then the running back's going to bounce outside, right?
No. You set me up,
uh-huh,
didn't you?
Yeah. Yeah.
He will be taking that ball to the heels, downhill to the heels of the offensive lineman.
Okay.
And then as that play, they overrun the play, which they do so often.
Yeah.
It's like water running off the table. He's going to bend it back to that short side, to that soft side. Mm-hmm. And then he's going to level his shoulders off to the goal line, going to look for a defensive back, and then he's going to run him over. But that will be diagrammed. Now, what will happen 100 years after I'm gone, they'll be walking through the cemetery, and some guy will be there with his son. He'll say, Dad, look at that. I've never seen anything like that. He says, I have no idea who that was, but he was one tough son of a gun.
In my experience, the power play bends back to that backside A-gap like you were explaining. I don't know, 1 in 5? But you're just picking the perfect instance of how you want your dream play to be, and I think there's something very admirable and respectable about that. And if I'm able to see that tombstone, that'll bring tears to my eyes and joy to my heart, and I think it will for many others.
I've not yet shared that with Jackie and the family, so maybe we ought to keep that between you and me.
And just our handful of listeners. So, yeah, and a lot of detail. We'll get to that later. Like I said, we got 20 or 30 years with you left to work on that. So, like I said, we'll be welcoming Alan Trammell on. We'll have a little bit of an extended version of Jack Talk here. We want to talk some movies and talk about I thought it'd be good to talk about coaching a team with a lot of starters coming back. I know you've had a variety of teams in your day, and we'll be returning a lot of starters here at Michigan. So, interested in your outlook on that. So before we get into our interview with Alan Trammell, would like to mention a show sponsor here, RX Bar, just recently on board with us, but they're whole food protein bars with simple, real ingredients. Their bars are made with 100% whole ingredients, things like egg whites, dates, nuts, really straightforward. It's a great on-the-go snack for you. In 2013, they saw a lot of bad protein bars filled with artificial ingredients, fillers, preservatives, yada, yada, yada. And really what they wanted to do is put the ingredients up front on the bar, create something delicious and outstanding. I've had one myself, more than one, but they are phenomenal. Three egg whites, two dates, six almonds, really straightforward. You can taste the cacao and the fruit that goes in them, and really shockingly good, I would say, beyond like the power bars and the and all the different, just the generic bars. So they've really taken the protein bar and the bar industry to a new level. Gluten-free, soy-free, dairy-free, no added sugar. Great for breakfast, snack at the office. And you can give them a shot, rxbar.com/attack. And you enter that at checkout for 25% off your order. Really just a great tasting bar to go. Reasonably priced, especially with 25% off your order. So again, visit rxbar.com/attack. That'll be the promo code attack, ATTACK, at checkout. And give them a shot. If you've liked MeUndies, if you've liked TrueCar, if you've liked any of the other stuff, or even if you haven't tried it, certainly suggest trying out the RX Bar. You order them online. Again, that's rxbar.com/attack. And enter the promo code attack at checkout. And you will be pleasantly surprised, I think, if you try the bars, and look forward to hearing what you have to say about them, because I know I like them myself. So when we come back, Alan Trammell.
Podcast One remembers broadcasting legend Dick Enberg.
A hearty welcome to Steve Kerr.
What a thrill to have listened to you all these years.
He's Basketball Hall of Famer John Calipari.
You still have a great voice of all time.
Tennis Hall of Famer Billie Jean King.
I just hope everyone listening understands what an icon you are.
He's my All-American friend Bill Walton.
Dick Enberg, I love you.
Listen to his amazing stories and his final interviews on Sound of Success, the Dick Enberg Podcast, only on Podcast One or the Podcast One app.
Now back to Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast.
Back on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast, we are here with the legendary John Falk, the all-time great Jack Harbaugh, and perhaps none better than Alan Trammell, Mr. Tiger, joining us today on Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's Podcast. Alan, welcome.
Well, thank you, gentlemen. How are you today?
Well, thank you. This is Jack Harbaugh. Congratulations, Alan, on your induction into the Hall of Fame. Outstanding.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I'll tell you what. I'm still trying to put it all together, Jack. Overwhelming, to be honest with you. I'm still pinching myself. The Hall of Fame, that sounds great. But when I put my name in front of it, I shake my head. But I'll tell you what, the Tigers are going to be well represented with Jack, obviously my teammate. We're both very, very, very proud. And we're going to find out here very shortly about a few others that are going to be joining us.
Alan, I got to ask what it's like for you and Jack to have waited so long and then to be going in together. I mean, what was the wait like? What's the feeling now that you guys are going in together? I mean, explain all the emotions that have taken place since, the early 2000s up until now.
Well, it's hard to really just to put it into a couple of sentences, but I mentioned overwhelming. I mean, both Jack and I are extremely proud. We're both going in with the old English D. His comments are a little bit different as far as the weight for me. I guess just because one of the thoughts that I have is that I've been in baseball since I signed out of high school. I've never done anything else. And so I've always been involved in doing things. And I kind of came to the realization, to be honest with you, that I know that I have a lot of people in my corner or had a lot of people in my corner, but, maybe I was a little bit short, and I was okay with that, guys, to be honest with you. I recognize that I was a pretty good ball player, but now when I got the call, my gosh, that just put that all to rest, to be part of this, the ultimate dream team. Again, I'm shaking my head as I say this, and, again, both Jack and I are extremely proud to represent the Tigers, and, hopefully we'll have a few others as we go further.
Well, before we talk about your pro days, I would like to talk about what it was like for you playing at Kearney High down in San Diego, because I'm a San Diegan. I played baseball at Coronado High, and then what it was like for you playing in the minors and kind of your early days before, being a pro, for 20 years. What was it like high school and minor leagues for you?
Well, first of all, when home is where your family is. Obviously, I grew up out here in San Diego. Some of the things that you have an advantage of is the weather, but that doesn't mean there's good ball players everywhere. And but the fact that you're able to go out year round and play different sports, I think to a certain degree is an advantage. I enjoyed it out here. Obviously, Jack, your son Jim was right down the street. USD, University of San Diego, is really just 2 miles down the road from where I went to high school. So He knows the area quite well. A beautiful area. Things were so different, guys, back in the mid-70s as far as the draft is concerned. My high school coach, we talked, and I knew that I was going to be drafted. But there was no publications. There was none of this, you know, media as far as where do they think they're going to be, you're going to be picked. So I was, as both parents, they wanted me and they encouraged me to go to school. I had signed a letter of intent to go to UCLA. That's what I was planning on doing. And when the Tigers drafted me in the second round, it kind of, you know, a little light went off in my head, like, wow, they must like me. My dream was to always to play professional, but I was going to go school first. But again, going back to the second round, I just thought, you know, here's an opportunity. My parents did not, you know, they wanted to make sure that I really wanted to play. I think I convinced them, and lo and behold, I signed the contract and off I went.
Alan, this is Jack again. As you move into the Hall of Fame, how about those that believed in you along the way and maybe believed in you before you did? What are your feelings and emotions about them?
Well, that's a great question, Jack, and you're right. I've had a lot of support for a long, long period of time. And part of this going into the Hall of Fame for me, obviously, it's the ultimate individual accomplishment. But I feel good for the Tiger fans, for the Tiger Nation all around the country that have supported myself and my teammates and Tigers for many, many years. And I think that, as we know in sports, that the fans will gravitate to, you know, players of their era. And, you know, I played a long time and for one team, which is something that I'm very, very proud of as well. And that there was a significant amount of fans during that era that, resonated with myself and Jack and Lou and Kirk Gibson and Dan Petrie and others. And it makes you feel good that, my name, my legacy will go on forever. But it's as a Tiger. When you look at the back of my baseball card, it says one team. Yeah. And that means an awful lot to me.
When you talk about the Tigers fans and Tiger Nation, we've got a big Tigers fan here in John Falk. And Johnny, I guess before we ask Alan, Alan, before we ask you what it was like to be a made man in Detroit in the 80s, I want to ask John Falk, what are your memories of Alan Trammell and being a Tigers fan in the 80s and being around the ballpark and everything?
You know what? Alan and I have been friends for, what, about 40 years? Big Trams?
Yeah.
And I'll tell you right now, Trams and Jack – and I got to be able to go down to the Tiger clubhouse a lot because Don Lund, of course, was an administrator here, so he took me down a lot. He played for the Tigers. And then when Sparky came in, Sparky let me in the clubhouse all the time. And I used to go in with Big Trams and Jack and talk to them all the time. And then another good of my friend was Tom Seaver. And I remember a game down at Detroit Tiger Stadium where Jack was going against Tom. And it was Tom later years. He played for the White Sox. And Big Trams came up in the eighth inning and hit a base hit off Tom. And they scored a run to go up 1-0. And they ended up beating Tom that day 1-0. So I went in the clubhouse after the game. And I went up to Big Trams to talk to him and talk to Jack. And Jack said, hey, John, go down and tell your buddy down there in the other clubhouse, the old man. You tell him that the young guy outpitched him today. And I said, you know what, Jack? I'll go down and say something to him. So I went down to see Tom. And I said, Tom, he said, what'd Morris say to you? And I said, well, Jack said that the young guy beat the old man today. He said, you go back and tell him that the old man pitched pretty good. And I'll tell you, Trams, Trams used to come to all of our baseball camps, too. He never missed a chance to come up and talk to all the campers about, you know, Tigers, about Trams. And our friendship has gone so deep that we keep in contact all the time. And Kirk Gibson and Big Trams. Remember the time, Big Trams, when I wore my M hat down to the clubhouse and I walked in when I had my M hat on, and I'm in there talking to you, and all of a sudden Gibby walks in. He said, uh-huh. Hey, Trams, I know that John's a friend of ours, but can he get that Michigan hat off?
Oh, God.
But I'll tell you, the memories with you and Trams, man, I'll tell you, it was so much fun. And the Tigers, the 84 team, and of course, you know, none of us are ever going to forget Sparky. How did Sparky handle all those guys? He told me one day, he says, Big John, I'm not the manager of this team. I'm a therapist. It's my job to make sure all these players play at their best. And the friendships that evolved out of there with you and Gibby and Jack and Dan Petrie. Dan Petrie has been such a friend. He came to my wedding. when Sherry and I got married. And that's when he was driving home that night when he found out he got traded to Los Angeles. And go ahead, Big Trams.
Well, I'm just thinking back, John, that, you know, the era, and obviously your mentor, Bo Schembechler, and mine was Sparky. That was an era that, again, you look back on very, very fondly, that we were taught the right way. And I know, Jack, that you were part of Bo's staff and feel the same way, that I know you gravitate to your time and your era. But you know what? My gosh, what a time it was, and how we were taught, whether it was football or baseball or basketball, whatever sport, that the lessons that we learned that we'll have for the rest of our lives. And I'm so appreciative that, you know, that Sparky was a part of my life. You know, early on, I didn't quite understand it. It was the tough love that kind of that era that we were brought up in. But now you look back and they knew exactly what they were doing. They taught us how to not only how to play, to be men, and to how to conduct yourself. There's so much more to it. And again, I'm thankful that our lives crossed.
Well, one other thing, Alan, a dear friend of mine, a guy that I went to high school with, we played football, basketball, and baseball together. We grew up on the sand lots before Little League and all that. It was Gates Brown. We lost him a couple years ago, and I know you shared some time with him in the 80s. When he was the batting instructor. Give me your best Gates Brown story, if you would.
Well, you know what, Jack? I'm glad you brought that up, because Gator was my first major league hitting coach. And I'm so, again, thinking back to the sessions and the conversations, you know, things were quite different, because, you know, now with the technology, there's all the video, and obviously that's the best way to go. The combination of talking and then looking at video is the way to go. But we didn't have that. And so really how we did it was more through conversations, sitting down, having conversations, trial and error. And Gator was just his personality and his thought process. I remember both, you know, for Lou Whitaker and myself, both of us, when we came up, we were young, we were skinny, we had no power, we hit the ball the other way. And Gator, as things evolved, started this kind of, he didn't come right out of the chute, just, you know, kind of let us kind of get our feet wet, but said, you know what, young man, they're pitching you inside, you're going to have to learn how to turn on some balls here and there. And as things evolved, you know, we learned how to do that. That was from Gator. Yeah. That was from Gator's tutelage, looking and watching his students, and at the right time, implementing, say, hey, guys, I think this is a time that you need to start doing a little of this. And you know what? Lo and behold, that he was right. And, you know, we both ended up learning how to do certain things. We always could go the other way. That was our bread and butter. But we learned how to hit and be able to, you know, get the head of the bat out when we needed to. And that was from Gator. And you're right. He was a good man. I know that the story about you guys going to high school. And we all loved Gator.
Well, thank you.
Alan, the 1984 World Series is something that will not soon be forgotten by Tigers fans. And you were the MVP of it, winning in five games over your hometown Padres, hitting .450 throughout the World Series. I wonder what it's like to be locked in, to be in the zone, to take your coaching and your ability to rise to the occasion and to perform so well throughout that World Series. What was that series like for you and winning that MVP honor?
Well, I mean, winning the championship was what it was all about. I mean, you know, looking back and fortunately I was hot and swinging the bat very well. But Jack very easily could have been the MVP. He won two games there out of the four. Kirk Gibson, we all know, game five, what he did with the two home runs and that big home run off of Goose. You know, it was just the dream year for us. And when you look back, there was one person that had a career year, and that was Willie Hernandez, who won the MVP and the Cy Young Award. But we had a lot of guys had really good, solid years, but nobody won 20 games. Nobody hit 30 home runs, and nobody had 100 RBIs.
Wow.
But we had a lot of guys, when you look down the lineup, we had a lot of balance. And it was just one of those things that, you know, Sparky pushed the right buttons that year. Everybody that he used, especially early in the year, to keep everybody coming out of spring training involved, everybody contributed. And, you know, we got off to that 35-5 start. Obviously, that gives you a lot of confidence, and we just carried it out throughout the season. And for me, a little special little footnote. though, because, again, I was coming home. I had been to the stadium here as a kid growing up, never played a game here, but to be able to play a World Series in my hometown was very, very special. And, you know, I'm just glad that that we were able to cap it off at the World Championship.
Well, you got to be able to stay with us at the sidelines here when we were down in San Diego, Big Trams. Remember that? All those bowl games down there we played together. You come on the sidelines, stand there, and you love that.
Absolutely,
you know?
The Holiday Bowl. Actually, a few weeks ago, I was there. We've been going with a group of people for a long, long time. But I do remember Michigan coming out a few times, and actually a couple times. You remember one time I went up? You guys were playing in the Rose Bowl.
You spoke to us.
I gave a few words, a little speech,
yes, you did.
Which was something that I'll never forget. But you guys, John, Jack, and University of Michigan, everybody there in the state of Michigan has treated me so good that, I'm very, very appreciative.
I wanted to ask you a question. I never got a chance to ask Sparky, but when Gibby was up there in the World Series and he and Sparky were yelling at each other about something while he's getting ready to bat and Goose was getting ready to pitch, what did he say to Kurt? Can you tell me that, Big Tramps? Did he think he was going to walk you?
He said he doesn't want to walk you because the thing about that, it's a good topic because at the time, I was standing right next to Sparky. I remember exactly what happened. But we didn't know that Dick Williams and Sparky were mic'd. And that's what makes this whole thing is that it is mic'd. And that they have that on whatever, you know, broadcast that they can bring that up. So the first base was open. Dick Williams wanted Goose to walk Gibby. He had already told him put the four fingers up, and he's shaking his head. So then Dick Williams walks out to the mound, and he's talking to Goose. And Goose has had great success against Gibby in his career. And so he talks Dick out of that. He goes, I think I can strike him out. I think I can strike him out. Well, we know what happened the second pitch when he hit that laser into the right field upper deck. But he was just yelling out, he doesn't want to walk you, big boy. And then he does with his little hands. He acts like he's got the little bat in his hand. And it's just, it's good theater there. And obviously for Gibby to come through with that home run was huge. And that's kind of was the clincher for us. But, you know, great story and great memories.
You know, growing up as a kid, Alan, you know, the memories for me of the Tigers were Cecil Fielder, like, literally hitting the ball out of the park and just muscling things out. Tell me your memories of old Tiger Stadium and playing there and how fond of a memory you have of that place.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind when I think of Tiger Stadium, it had a great baseball atmosphere. And I know it's not the modern, you know, stadiums with all that, but I loved playing there. The completely double-deck enclosed stadium. And when the people were, When it was, you know, 40,000 plus, man, that place rocked. And when the people were, stomping their feet, it felt like the place was going to fall down. It was just an incredible feeling in there. And I think it had an advantage. We had an advantage.
You know, one guy we need to talk about, I think, Tramps, is Dave Bergman. What a great guy he was. Don't you agree?
Oh, my gosh. A great teammate, obviously. His life was lost too early. As too many of all of people that we know, it's unfortunate that happened. But the fact of the matter is, back in '84, we weren't wire to wire, but there was a time in early June that Toronto was not that far behind us, and there was a Monday night baseball game that Dave Bergman had the biggest at bat for us during the course of
that season.
He had a 13 pitch at bat against Roy Lee Jackson in the 10th inning and hit a 3-run homer walk off to win the game. And every game when you're playing somebody, it's a 2-game swing. And, you know, it gave us a little bit of a cushion and people forget that, oh, they just think that we just walked through the season. And that's not quite true. There's a couple times that, that we went through a couple little skids and we had to get back on track. That was one of them when Dave Bergman had that biggest at bat of the season that a lot of people, you know, tend to forget. But great teammate. One of the many unsung heroes that we had, but Berge was a very, very important part of that club.
One last thought here on my part. How sweet will it be for you when Sweet Lou follows you into the hall?
Oh, my God. Well, I've said many times, Jack, that my dream, and again, I'm entitled to my opinion and my dream, that I was hoping that that Lou and I could go in together. I think it's a great story. It is a great story. The fact that it's not going to happen this year, and I'm going in with another teammate, Jack, is just as cool. I mean, there's no question about it. But now that I'm in, I'm hoping that over the course of the next few years that there's somehow some way that I can, you know, somehow stimulate this. But first of all, we got to get him back on the ballot.
Yeah.
But at some point, I believe that it is going to happen. And that is still a dream of mine that that Lou Whitaker and Alan Trammell will be in as a double play combination. Yeah. Along with Jack Morris and Sparky and others, but that will happen someday. And again, that's my dream, and that's something that I'm gonna hold out for until the end of time.
Well, they got my vote. I can tell you that right now, if it means anything.
I appreciate that. This guy does not get the love that he deserves. I'm not sure why. I know that there's other players that haven't either. But my gosh, what a tremendous player! And to be able to say he was my sidekick for 19 seasons,
wow.
A major league record for a double play combination.
That will never. With the situation in major leagues with players moving around and football players moving around, that will never, ever happen again, in my opinion. 19
well,
years.
I tend to agree with that. You hate to say never, but my gosh, again, the way things have gone in sports, it's highly, highly unlikely. And the fact, again, that Lou and I both, when you look at both of our baseball cards and it says the Detroit Tigers,
right.
One team on both is very special.
You know, I was happy when I was talking to you the other day on the phone, Trams, that you said that Ron Gottenhar is a guy just like us. Seems like to me he must be pretty good.
He is.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, Big John, he is one of us. He is the right man for the job. I mean, we know that we're tearing this thing down. It's something that is painful as it is. We have to do. But he is the right man to do this. He's done this again with the Minnesota Twins before, where you know they had a limited budget. And you know what? He's won quite a few division titles. He is a teacher. He is cherishing this role. And you know what? I know there's going to be probably a couple of years that it might be a little bit bleak. But you know what? Things can happen quickly. And, you know, if we can draft correctly and some of our younger players can, the opportunity is here. It's a good time to be a Tiger, guys, because the opportunity is there for them. And hopefully some of these guys can take that and run with it. But we have the right man in Ron Gottenhar.
That's good to hear, Janet.
Alan, I've got two more for you. The first one is,
sure.
How many times have you gone to Cooperstown prior to when you go this summer?
Well, I've been over, oh my gosh, over my baseball career, I've been there probably, I don't know, 6 or 7 times for various things, whether back in the days when they used to rotate an exhibition game, which no longer is part of it. I was there. Not last year, but the two previous years, they do something around Memorial Day that every team is represented, and I represented the Tigers. I'm going to be coming. Obviously, the end of July is going to be the induction ceremony, which I will be there, obviously. But they ask every inductee sometime prior, so I'm thinking sometime in March. It's just your spouse and yourself. They kind of give you a couple day tour. They just to kind of where everything is much more low key and kind of go through a little walkthrough, so to speak. And that's coming up. So I have not set that date yet, but they really, the Hall of Fame, my gosh, in a month's time, this the way that they treat you, your wife, they want, you know, you're part of a family forever now. And it's very special, as it should be. And they're making us feel as welcome as they possibly can.
And who will be speaking on your behalf there?
Well, you know what? It's different in baseball. They don't have somebody to. And if there was, it would have been Sparky. But they don't. They don't do it like football, where they have somebody come up,
okay,
and introduce you. It's just Jane Forbes Clark who will say, and now because I've been watching some film, they sent me some DVDs about some of the past speeches, just to get you kind of a feel of what's going on, give you, you know, prepare yourself, which is what I obviously would love, you know, I'm going to be. There is nobody that comes in and introduces you, so to speak. It's just more or less Jane Forbes Clark, the chairman of the of the museum, the Hall of Fame, will just say, and now it's Alan Trammell, now it's Jack Morse, and I'm sure there's going to be three or four or five others here, like I mentioned, in a couple of weeks that are going to be part of this great class.
And then the last one I have for you, since none of us will be able to do it, I want to ask you what it's like to hit a home run in the World Series and then to hit them in back-to-back at-bats and to effectively have won Game 4. What was that like? I mean, were you like floating on clouds going around the bases? I mean, what was that memory like for you?
Oh, I was. My feet were barely touching the ground, I can tell you that. It was just one of those things that, going back to the very first game, you know, Lou got a double. And on the first pitch, I hit a base hit, and we were up 1-0. And that was kind of like how the year went so often, is that we jumped out on the opposing team really early, and we would add on. Well, in Game 4, the thing that makes it a little more – Jack goes 9, and we win 4-2, but both the home runs that I hit my first two times up with Lou Whitaker on base were two-run homers, and we won 4-2. So those meant something. But to say that you're on cloud 9 when you're running around the base, all you're trying to do is contribute. That's all you're trying to do. And it just so happened at that particular time, I probably was as hot as I've ever been. And lo and behold, it was at the right time.
Well, were you looking for a pitch in a spot? Or, walk me through the at-bats
a
little bit.
Well, you know what? Both times I was in a hitter's count. Both were 2-0. So I knew Eric Schau. He liked to throw his slider. Well, when you're 2-0, a lot of times when they throw a breaking ball, it's not really their best one. It's one that they're just trying to get over for a strike. So it was basically a spinner slider. It was a strike. It just moved a little bit. It just kind of moved like right into my sweet spot of my back. And I was able to, to get the loft on that. But at that time, when you're hitting, and this goes back to, talking about Gates Brown, when you're heading the count, this is the time that maybe you want to be a little more aggressive and try to get that head of the bat out a little bit. And that's really what I was doing. Not that I was trying to hit a home run, but I was trying to drive the ball a little bit because I was ahead of the count. And those are the kinds of things that you learn a little bit with experience. And again, that goes back to Gates Brown.
Did you or your teammates have to pay for anything in 1984 or 1985 in the city of Detroit?
No. And you know what, guys? To be honest with you, the Michiganders and the people in Detroit there, for so many years, my gosh, I don't remember paying for too many meals over the majority of my career. And that's just how special that place is to play. I mean, they've treated their athletes, not just baseball. I like to say it's all the sports. And how they've treated you. If you play there, and I've tried to tell our younger players there with the Tigers to say, see this old man here? I haven't played in over 20 years. You see how they treat me? This is how it could be for you. Do you realize this? And I just try to give them a little bit of a wake-up call, because it can be and it will be the same for somebody that's going to play in Detroit for a long period of time. They don't forget. And it's a very, very special place to play.
I want to go on record as saying that nobody will treat Alan Trammell better than the Michigan football program. We gave him a jersey last year. You've got carte blanche for sideline passes. Big Johnny, Jack, and myself will make sure that Alan Trammell is a made man in Ann Arbor as long as you are around.
Well, again, man, I know that, and it's very much appreciated, guys. Again, it's just been a special relationship. Look forward to seeing you guys here in the near future, and you guys, thank you for having me.
And thank you for what you've done for the game of baseball and the state of Michigan. Thank you very much.
Yeah, Jack, if they
– All right, guys.
All right, Tramps, thank you, man.
Have a great day, guys.
Right,
thanks,
Alan.
Bye
you
now.
Too. Great stuff with Alan Trammell and Big Johnny. And before we get into Jack Talk here, just want to mention another show sponsor, TrueCar. They've been with us for the majority of our show, and they've got some useful tips that you might not be aware of, like a coffee filter and a little bit of olive oil can clean your interior, and then removing excess weight from your car will improve gas mileage. And apparently you can place your key fob to your chin to increase its range. I don't know if that one is necessarily factual, but I'm reading it. That's what they tell me to say. I don't know how that would increase your range, but here's another tip. TrueCar also helps people get used cars. That's right. TrueCar isn't just for buying new cars. With their certified dealer network and nationwide inventory of nearly 1 million used cars, you'll enjoy real pricing on actual inventory and a simpler car buying experience, whether you buy new or used. And with TrueCar, users can see what other people paid, so you know exactly if you're getting a good deal or an average deal or anything like that before you buy. So you're more likely to enjoy a faster buying experience by connecting with TrueCar certified dealers. So when you are ready to buy a new or used car, check out TrueCar and enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states, but what is available in all states is saving over an average of $3,000 off the manufacturer's suggested retail price only with TrueCar. And without any further ado, we've got Jack Talk, and we've got so many different ways we can go with Jack Talk, but we'd like to start off by mentioning the passing of Dick Enberg and of Keith Jackson, and I know that you've got plenty of recollections. You know, with me, it was always, whoa, Nelly, we've got a hot one. And the, you know, the naming of the big house and all that stuff. And Jack and Big Johnny here, I know you guys have stories, but Jack, we'll let John start off with your memory of Keith Jackson.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, when I came up from Miami of Ohio back in 1974, I worked for Bill Mowry at Miami. Well, Bill Mowry happened to be coach in Colorado. And Milan Vuletic, who coached with us here, and everybody was down in the tunnel on Friday. And Milan Vuletic looked around and he goes, this stadium isn't very much. John, this doesn't look very good at all. What the world? Well, Keith Jackson had to be standing right behind us. And he put his hand on Milan's shoulder and he said, you don't think so today. Just wait until tomorrow. Just wait until tomorrow. And the other great story about Keith was that back in 06, we went to the Rose Bowl. And Keith invited the staff over to his golf course to have dinner that night. And when we walked in, I mean, Keith was like a Michigan guy. I mean, he got along with everybody. He came over, put his arm around me and says, Big John, I'm really happy to see you here. And Lloyd and all those guys. And it was really fun to be with Keith Jackson, just to hear him talk about his stories. And then the most memorable one that I didn't hear it live because I was on the field, but I watched the tape, was when Brian Griese came in 1996 against Ohio State. At the half, we switched quarterbacks to Brian Griese. And Brian came in and threw that touchdown pass. And at the end of the game, old Keith says to Bob Griese, well, sees your boy did pretty good, didn't he? And Bob Griese cried. It was such a great thing to watch. I mean, to see him do your son. And then to come out the next year, 1997, Bob Griese was the quarterback at Purdue, took him to the Rose Bowl. Bob Griese was the quarterback at the Miami Dolphins, and they went undefeated. Brian Griese comes to Michigan. He wins the national championship, wins the Rose Bowl, and also he had just a great time while he was here. And I really enjoyed that.
It's interesting, too, John, that Brian Griese then worked color for Keith Jackson a couple years down the road when he came back to Michigan to do that, what everyone thought at the time was his last game, when he was honored by the band.
They said hi to Keith on the field.
On the field.
Yes.
I read a story in New York Times yesterday that he was doing the game with Brian Griese, and came halftime, the producer of the show said, Keith, stick around at halftime. We want you to do a 10-minute spot at halftime. And Keith went berserk. 10-minute spot at halftime. We're paying people here millions of dollars, and we can't find someone to do a 10-minute spot at halftime. And he kind of stomped out of the broadcasting booth and came back and found out it was all a setup. They were doing a halftime show in his honor. Bo showed up with an autographed helmet, Michigan helmet, autographed jersey. The band spelled out, I think, thank you, Keith, or something
you, Keith.
Of that nature. And he realized that they were bringing him back not through that 10-minute spot, so he would be in the press box so he could enjoy that
particular They were honoring
moment.
Him, and here he was, thought that he was going to be overworked.
Came back in with a little attitude.
Well, I think that Keith Jackson is a guy that very much is cut from the Harbaugh cloth. We had a couple people on Twitter. Matthew Silberman, through the hashtag Attack Each Day, said better today than yesterday, better tomorrow than today. And then Brady Streitenberger said things are never, it is what it is, they are what you make them. So we've got people out there that are taking the mantras just like Keith Jackson and really running with them. Wanted to transition into talking about the Michigan team that we've got returning. That's returning a lot of starters. You know, we lost, I don't know, 2 years ago, maybe 18-ish starters. We're returning about that many this season. And Johnny, we'll have you weigh in on this after Coach Jack. But how does coaching change when you're returning a lot of starters? What does the spring look like? What does the summer look like? What's been your experience in coaching veteran teams?
Coached all kind of teams. Some of the teams I've enjoyed most are young teams, teams that are still trying to find their way, starting positions, leadership type roles. What I always look for in a team is a team of leaders. And it could be older teams, veteran teams, they could be young teams, but team with leaders. And I'm bringing Jason Michael. We talked about him last week. Offensive coordinator for the Tennessee Titans. Was on our 2002 team. He was a quarterback. It was a veteran team. The year before, we had probably better football players. Three or four of them went into the NFL. But this was a team. Jason was a five-year senior. We're playing Northern Iowa. We had a 2-3 record, two wins, three losses. Looked like we were going absolutely nowhere. We're playing in the dome, the mini dome up there. Noisy place to play, very tight confines. We played well in the halftime. We were leading, but the game was very much in question. We came into the locker room, and we made some adjustments, and it was time to go onto the field. And I said a few words, and Jason Michael stood up. He said, "Coach, I have something that I want to say." He said, "I'm a five-year senior. This is my first year starting. We have a chance to do something special. This is a veteran team. This is a good team. This is a team I'm proud to be on. I'm telling you, I'm pledging to you, I'm going to go out and I'm going to play the greatest game of my entire career. I challenge you to do the same. I'm walking out the door. Follow me out if you're pledging to do the same as I'm doing." And I want you to know, I was the first guy to get behind him. I'm with you, Jason. So we all kind of line up and go out, and we kick their tails every possible way a tail could be kicked. We must have rushed for about 300 yards. I mean, it was an out-and-out blowout. We never lost another game in that season. And it was not because of anything that a coach said or anything that it was because a leader stood up. So I would judge this team, the team that's coming up, by the number of leaders and the players that have that kind of passion, players that have that kind of feeling about each other. And in most cases, those are successful teams. And one other point. The best teams I ever coached were the ones where very few problems got to me as a head coach. Those problems were being solved at a level amongst the players, the leadership group. Bo used to call it, right, John, senior leaders.
Senior leaders.
Senior leaders. If those senior leaders are taking care of those problems and they weren't getting to the coaching level, you have a chance for success. But if every day you walk in, there's three or four things that are coming to you, they aren't being addressed, you know, by that leadership group, by your assistant coaches, and then they come to you. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question, but those are the kinds of teams that you look for as a football coach.
And, Johnny, you know, I think the 96-97 team, as far as I can understand it, the 96 team had a lot of really good athletes, just like Jack's 01 Western Kentucky team. But that team set the table for the 97 team, right?
Yes,
is that
did.
Fair to say?
That's fair to say. You always set the table for the next year from the team before. And I want to bring up John Navarre. John Navarre was a great quarterback here at Michigan. In 2003, we were at Michigan State, and we beat them 27-20 in a great football game. After the game in that locker room, John Navarre did exactly what you're talking about, Jack. He got up and turned around and said, "Men, I want you to know something. We got two games left. We got to go to Northwestern, then we got to go back and play Ohio State. And I want you to know I'm going to do everything I can to win this championship for Michigan. I'm going to do everything I can, and I'm asking each and every one of you to follow me, take with me, and let's all play our best for the next 2 weeks so that we can win this Big Ten championship." Those are the kind of guys that you look at. John Jansen, in 1997, he was one of the best captains we had, he and Greece and those guys. But in 1998, if you recall, we started out slow. We lost the first two games. And I started going around the locker room, and I started watching players, and I realized one thing. They all thought it was 1997. Mm-hmm. They all thought that, oh, well, we'll just show up and we could win the game because we were undefeated last year. So I started going in the locker room every night, and I kept saying, "Hey, men, this is our team. This is the 1998 team. We're not 97 anymore. This is our team." So I went to John Jansen, and I said, "John, listen, you're going to have to talk to the players because they still think that it's just as easy as you think back in 97 to make it that way in 1998, and that's not the way it is. This is a whole new team and a whole new way to look at things." And I said, "John, if you could just talk to these guys, well, by gosh, he had a team meeting as soon as I got done talking to him. He took him into that meeting room, and he said, "Hey, man, this is our team now. We're playing for the Michigan team of 1998, not 1997 and not 1999, 1998. And we need to get on the same page for all of us to play as hard as we can to win this season." And you know what? We turned it around. We won the championship. And that was just the type of leaders that you look for when you go in there. And I used to walk around the locker room every day looking at players and talking to them and find out who the leaders are in the team. And I love that. That was fun for me.
That's awesome. Well, we want to say thank you to to Alan Trammell for coming on. Big John, definitely want to thank you. It's always nice we can share share the time with you. And we're looking forward to tracking down some good guests going forward. We're thinking maybe Randy Moss, Scott Van Pelt perhaps, John Beilein, you know, when things die down for him. Perhaps Steve Ross, the owner of the Dolphins. But want to thank Podcast One, True Car, RX Bar, and we've got a new Twitter handle. So if people want to get in touch with us, it is at AED Podcast, Attack Each Day Podcast. And that's where we'll be releasing the podcast from and engaging with listeners and everything. So now that we're out of the season, we can dedicate a little bit more time to having this thing run in the way that it's supposed to. And I guess one more thing, we got a lot of Michigan Wolverines still left in the playoffs here. Tom Brady, Alan Branch, David Harris, Chad Henne, Patrick Omame, Jared Wilson, Brandon Graham, and Ben Gideon. So we are guaranteed a minimum of four players, and perhaps if the Jaguars can pull out the AFC Championship, we could have Ty Wheatley, who was a running backs coach last year here. Now with the Jaguars, we could have them. We could have him in the Super Bowl. So lots of Wolverines representing well for the winged helmet. So that'll do it for us. Like I said, thank you to everybody. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us 5 stars. Write a review. Listen every week. Look forward to having another great episode next week. And until then, keep attacking each day with an enthusiasm unknown to mankind.
Thank you for listening to Attack Each Day, the Harbaugh's podcast, here on Podcast One. Don't forget to subscribe at podcastone.com, the Podcast One app, or Apple Podcasts.
Hi, this is Dennis Miller, and I want to invite you to listen to my new podcast, Red Circle Sports, right here on Podcast One. I'll be recapping the weekend's most exciting sports stories, and I'll bring them to you every Tuesday. Plus, hear me chat with some of my favorite sports industry guests like Rich Eisen. So be sure to subscribe to Red Circle Sports with me, Dennis Miller, on the Podcast One app at podcastone.com or on Apple Podcasts. And don't forget to rate, review, and share. Be there or be square.